The next station or account is 98-1099, 98-1107, Gertrude Collins versus Downriver Specialty Inc. Mr. McLaughlin.
May it please the court, I'm Patrick McLaughlin, counsel for Gertrude Collins, the mother of Alan Howell, and the deceased. Joined the table with David Flores, counsel for Kenneth Wilkerson. We have joined together on briefs before this court, and we have agreed to split our time in argument today. We ask Chief Justice for 2 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Flores will conduct the rebuttal.
Watch your time closely there.
If we adopted Section 344 of the restatement, does that mean you win?
No, we can win without the court adopting 344.
But if we adopted 344, you clearly would win, is that right?
We certainly believe we should go to the jury. Yes, yes, Justice.
One thing I should mention at this time, we
have also agreed, of course, to divide the issues, and I generally, although certainly that doesn't restrain the court in any way, but I'm going to take the argument pretty much on the directed verdict from Mr. Forrest on the restatement of Section 344.
Okay. Then will you handle the question on 212501A1? You don't respond to that in your reply brief, nor did you discuss it in your opening brief, and they raised the issue. That is that the there's no liability under wrongful death.
Well, Your Honor, we don't believe that was appropriately raised, and certainly not considered by the trial court as part of the court's record for it. We believe that was appropriately raised below, but in response to that, we would say that, as I have said, that Al died 38 hours after he was shot at the hospital. The statute clearly contemplates death on the premises. Al did not die on the premises. In addition, the statute also indicates that there is a need to violent, unprovoked act of a third person in order to get the gross negligence. We believe, Justice Douglas said, this was violent, provoked by the negligence and inadequate security. That would be my response to that question.
And why, again, doesn't A1 apply? Because it...
Well, the statute contemplates, as I recall, the death occurring on the premises.
And he died at the hospital.
He did die some 38 hours.
Yes, yes.
So we think the plain reading of that statute would eliminate the gross negligence aspect of that.
Counsel, one of the problems with your theory is, of course, the ability of the non.
Yes.
To establish the stability. Yeah, but I think the reason, in fact, you even see this here in your comment page 6, Tyler knew of the problem, he knew that the Brown was being granted, he knew that there had been a prior shooting in Jackson, yet he did not foresee the shooting, he did not anticipate it. If a person who's so intimately acquainted with this gentleman in his history can't foresee it, how could you ever prove a trial that this bond was destroyed?
Well, Justice Strand, we don't believe that Ken Tyler is an agent of Alan Howell, serving for parents and colleagues, but Ken Tyler is not in a position to know what numbers do. Ken Tyler is not in any position to know about the fact that numbers is located in a high crime area in the city of Cleveland.
But that doesn't matter. The fact that it's in a high crime area doesn't necessarily mean that Brown is a high crime person.
It does not.
I mean, just because of the high crime area, that's this person's going to be attacked.
Yes, that is correct. And we would believe that the law does not require knowledge to any specific person, but knowledge that a violent act of a third person could occur on the premises.
You can see that there's a difference between a general knowledge by a bar of a tendency for there to be vandalism in that sort of person and general sort of crime type stuff, versus the knowledge that a jealous lover is going to shoot a patron. I mean, there seems to be a difference I can follow your argument a lot better, and that's usually the common scenario we see. But when you take it to a different level, that you have a jealous rage and a shooting out of jealousy, you know, where's the history that this bar had experienced jealous rages from lovers?
Right.
That's a different quality, a different quantity of risk.
It is.
And so it's a totally different issue for the abilities.
It is, and we have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and that's why we work very hard at trial to bring in all of the evidence that numbers do or should have known, not with respect necessarily to Lydell Brown, but with respect to patrons in general that come to numbers. We established through expert testimony that numbers is located in a high crime area in downtown Cleveland. In fact, we had a property that did borders on the two highest census tracts in the city of Cleveland.
Had patrons been found with firearms in the bar before?
Justice Sweeney, the evidence at trial was that on one occasion, Officer Dunley, who worked there two or three times a month, in a pat-down, took a handgun, a weapon off of an individual trying to gain entrance to numbers. In addition,
why did he do that?
Well, clearly, because he knew, as a police officer, that there was a danger. In fact, as he testified, when there was probable cause to conduct a pat-down, he did so. He did it to look for weapons.
Did he have prior knowledge from someone saying, watch this guy, he's got a gun on him? Well, why did he pat him down?
Through experience and because of the nature of the fact that he's working in numbers in this track in downtown Cleveland.
So it was to his best knowledge of police activity, police work, that this type of location presented some type of threat of carrying a gun?
That's correct. And that plus his experience working at the establishment. He had made at least 5 arrests that he could recall. He testified at trial that there were a number of other occasions when he could have arrested but chose not to do so. In addition, the testimony at trial from patrons demonstrated that a handgun, for example, was part of an incident in the parking lot. It didn't happen to be on a night when Officer Dunley was working. But there's plenty of evidence in the record of handguns and of violence in the establishment.
And did the owners have knowledge of these things that he did?
They did. Officer Dunley testified that the handgun incident to management, and of course he conveyed other incidents to management. Well, the management was on site, by and large, everything that was Mr. Tricola testified. We call him the cross-examination. The evidence here was, and I hate to use the word overwhelming because part of the confusion, certainly in Kyle recounting, gets to the language of the briefs and the versus makeup, I mean, the somewhat overwhelming practical effect of that.
Well, it seems that the management was knowledgeable of problems in the parking lot.
They had
police in the parking lot.
They did.
And they had people also in the restrooms or patrolling the restrooms because they were knowledgeable about problems occurring there. But it seemed that they were pretty confident that nothing was happening in the bar itself. So, and to my knowledge, from reading it, they didn't have anybody in the bar itself.
There was no security on the inside. Security was provided for the automobiles in the parking lot. There was no security for 275 patrons inside numbers on the night in question.
Did they have any reason to have security in the bar?
They did indeed. And the reason, for all the reasons we've talked about in terms of the totality of the circumstances, it's for the reason that they would pat down patrons as they would come into the establishment. They would check ID. It's for the reason that they were aware of prior incidents of fights in the premises and outside of the parking lot.
Is a bar that caters to the clientele of this bar more inclined to have different problems than other bars?
John Franson, a 26-year veteran of the Cleveland Police Department, and 10 years of which the supervisor of the homicide, we called as our expert witness at Tonsha Brown. Mr. Franson testified that in his experience, that young men of this age, men generally in their early 20s, and unfortunately late teens too, because the evidence showed that numbers was admitting a number of underage individuals, including Lydell Brown, the shooter, notwithstanding their claim that they checked IDs, this age group is particularly prone to violence. And he also testified that young black males in that age group have a greater risk of being a victim of crime. So clearly there's evidence in the record.
And yet, Appley cites the fact that there was fewer than one arrest per year in 8 years. That doesn't sound like a very violent place inside. Isn't it true that oftentimes establishments like this in a neighborhood, such as you described, provide security outside, partly to check the people coming in, but also to make people coming into the place feel safe? It's a safe place not just to protect cars, but to protect the patrons from people that might come from the surrounding area and attack them, steal, rob, and that sort of thing.
I'm sure that was part of it, and I'm sure in downtown Cleveland, in the census tract, we must do that. And numbers did. Unfortunately, many of those same patrons who might otherwise cause those problems are now inside the establishment, drinking alcohol, and engaged sometimes in violent activity. On the night in question, the circumstances of Vidal Brown. Had there been security inside, and John Franson testified at trial, Vidal's bizarre behavior, his confrontation against Vidal on the dance floor on two occasions, his bizarre behavior when in July he pulled the sweatshirt a little over his head and looked around the bar for 40 minutes. All of this could have been observed, could have been noticed, and security could have taken some action to protect against this unfortunate tragedy. Nothing was done because there was no security inside, and there was nobody to take any action.
What are they going to do? Go up to and say, you kind of acted a little weird, you got your foot over your head, so we're going to kick you out, and you think you might commit homicide?
No, Justice Rathout, that's the approach by the trained security officer. Good approach to make a judgment call, as officers must do daily, whether or not someone is in an agitated state, may cause a problem, or in this case, had a weapon on. Unfortunately, Vidal Brown was subjected to it. Look at that. Had he been, then his weapon could have been confiscated or been denied admission to the premises. I'm concerned about my time.
Yeah, I think you're
probably. I must need some for my co-counsel to be very upset with me. But if there are no other questions,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Mr. Forrest.
This court is presented today with an opportunity to recognize Restatement 344 of the Restatement of Torts as a civil law. This court has faced the issue two times, mentioned it in Simpson v. Big Bear. Chief Justice Moyer indicated that 344 may indeed be the law already, but that was not the right case. That was a case that involved a defendant who was not in possession of the property where the incident occurred. Justice Rossi and Chief Justice Moyer seem to agree that indeed Restatement 344 may be the law. The question is whether or not in Big Bear that would be appropriate case. It wasn't because it had been off the ground. There's no reason for any division of the court any longer with this case, because there's no question that the killing and the shooting occurred on the defendant's property and they were under control. The question was asked, if we adopt Restatement 344, do we win? I think that in either case, either under the Simpson syllabus, which was the law, versus the Reese case, which was not, or under the adoption of 344, the case should have gone to the jury. I can't answer, I can only presume to answer, who would want the case, but the case should have gone to a jury.
I meant win here. That's all we're dealing with.
Yeah. Then yes, but I would suggest Justice Douglas that even if this court were to for some reason decide not to adopt 344, still this law in Ohio, we should still win here, because under the Simpson versus Big Bear test, the syllabus, this case should have gone to a jury, and that's what we're asking for. We're going to go to a jury. What the Reese case did, what the trial judge specifically in the directed verdict indicated he was following Reese. The Reese case says when you're using the other circumstance foreseeability, the evidence must be, quote, somewhat overwhelming. And that is a very difficult phrase even to understand. Imagine for a moment trying to define for a jury, assuming that the case gets beyond a directed verdict and we are now instructing the jury. How do you define the term somewhat overwhelming to a juror? It really makes no sense. I looked in Webster Dictionary the other night, and definition of overwhelming is to flood or engulf, to overcome utterly. That seems to be even stronger than the language that a criminal defendant is entitled to in terms of the beyond a reasonable doubt. It seems to establish another test just because in a particular case, proof foreseeability, you are using so-called other circumstances. The concept of using other circumstances rather than direct injuries on the premises is analogous to other situations in negligence law. Keep in mind, one of the benefits of Restatement 344 is it treats the negligent acts of third parties, the intentional acts of third parties, and for that matter, the acts of animals in the same manner. In other words, it's the same standard to be applied. Was the landowner liable because the acts of that third entity were foreseeable? The other circumstances are used to prove foreseeability in many cases. For example, in a slip and fall in a store, if you can't prove that the store had actual knowledge of the object being on the ground, you use other circumstances. For example, how long it had been there, how many people had passed by, that sort of thing. It's a concept that exists in our law for a long time. There is no reason under the Reese case to require this somewhat overwhelming standard for this case simply because it occurred as a result of an intentional criminal act of a third party. The evidence in this case, particularly in this case, was very strong applying the other circumstances. We had the evidence of Officer Dunleavy, who indicated that he had found the gun on a prior occasion, reported it to the owner, he had patted people down. We had Mr. Klingscale and Mr. Tyler testify about fights that had occurred within the premises and outside the premises. There was one incident where a fight started in the parking lot, and one of the combatants came and pointed a gun at the people at the front.
We've read all those facts and we understand them. I want to go back to 344 in the law a minute, because that's really important here. Three of us in dissent said that, written by Justice Resnick, that 344 should be elevated to syllabus law. Isn't that about what the syllabus in Simpson says anyway?
Close.
Other than the last sentence, which is not applicable here.
The only difference between the two is, I won't read 344 in its entirety, but what 344...
Please don't.
...is not contained in it is the word that is contained in the Big Bear Simpson, substantial risk of harm,
mm-hmm.
That there is a substantial risk of harm. That is not contained in 344. I think that 344 makes the term substantial risk of harm superfluous or unnecessary because the elements are there, they're clearly there in 344.
It's presumed in 344.
Right.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's pretty close.
Okay, so that the question is, did they apply even the syllabus as it exists in Simpson correctly? You say the trial court didn't.
Yes, we say the trial court did not. We would refer to the dissent of Justice Scalise, who, in a very cogent opinion, laid out the reasons why it was incorrectly applied, mainly because of the various factors.
I read it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. Mr. Keller.
Well, I'm Stan Keller. Brian Smith in my office. Counsel said that the killing shooting took place on the premises. I think that is responsive to Justice Douglas's remark as to does this section of the code apply. If it does, then the plaintiffs have the burden of proving gross neglect on the part of the defendants, and they didn't do it. And under that statute, they should recover, and I believe that they did. state and state's cause of action, or prove a cause of action at the trial.
That language does say, however, sir, killed on the premises.
I'm sorry?
The language does say killed on the premises.
Well, that's true.
Okay.
But that's like saying that someone was in an automobile accident and died in a hospital, and they're going to sue for wrongful death as a result of an auto accident, and I ask the defense counsel to say, well, wait a minute, he died in a hospital. He didn't die in the auto accident. I don't think it makes a difference where he died. This is where he was shot, and that shooting was caused his death. But going back for a moment...
Except, just, and then I'll get off it, but it's very specific about saying on the property. Now, that would distinguish it from your auto accident.
I don't know how to answer. All I know is he was shot as a result of the shooting on the property. He died 13 hours or whatever number of hours later. I would think the killing took place on the premises and not in the hospital. That's the way I would consider it. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but that's my perception of it anyway. The facts of the case are that a young man was killed in a bar to a business invitee. And any case that I've looked at says that the owner of this bar was not an insurer of the safety of this young man. And they use it in the sense that if a third person commits an intentional willful act in killing a business invitee, that business owner is not liable. Now, when we're talking about this bar, had you never been to Cleveland, you would think that this was in the roughest neighborhood in the entire city. It happens to be in the most upscale neighborhood in the whole city. It is where all the stadiums are located. It is where the Justice Center, the City Hall, the Rock Museum, the Terminal Tower, all the fine restaurants, all the fine condos, everything is built in this area. So it's not, the census tract, I believe, is misleading because it takes into consideration the east side of the Cahoga River and the Flats, and that probably is where all the problems are. But this is right behind a restaurant called Johnny's, which is probably one of the finest restaurants in Cleveland. But nevertheless, they never had this problem. Four or five fights in 8 years, no shootings, no killings, no stabbings. All of the witnesses called by the plaintiff all agreed this was the finest gay bar you could go to. Now, their expert, by the way, is an ex-homicide detective with 25 years' experience. First case has ever been called upon because Mr. McLaughlin's partner's father and he were both on the same force together. And he acknowledged that, you know, this was his first case and he was a security person in charge of Tower City. And he describes that black males ages 20 to 28 are more susceptible to violence to them and against them.
Was he not qualified as an expert?
I objected, but Judge Neal overruled it, so my opinion, no, he was not. I mean, under the cases, one time being called as an expert, being as a security guard, as a security manager at Terminal Tower, Tower City, having only worked a few times in a bar during his 25 years, I don't believe that he was. But this was a directed verdict, so you have to look at things most favorable to the plaintiffs. But my position is that we weren't an insurer. And even under the restatement, if you look at F, they still require, 344F, they still require knowledge on our part. What was the knowledge on our part of Vidal Brown going to commit a crime? How was he dressed? Well, on page 12, on page 47-48, I was cross-examining Officer O'Malley, and he said, looking at photos of all the other kids in the bar, he said, he looked the same as all the other kids. Having saw the Academy Awards not too long ago, I mean, any style of dress, hoods, etc., are apropos. And these were young people there. There's no way you can anticipate that this young man was carrying a gun. And because a person doesn't look right, you just bank off and frisk him. And a police officer stands outside the bar because, according What I learned in this case, a police officer is not allowed in the bar to work in the bar as a security guard. He has to be outside the bar. And there were other security people in the bar at the time. The only people that knew that this may be a lover's quarrel were the witnesses called by the plaintiffs. And every one of those witnesses felt and said they never dreamt, using my words, in a million years that such a thing would occur. They weren't concerned about it. One of the young boys, Kenny Tyler, who was the object of the affection of the Dal Brown and Alan Howell, who was the deceased, he never anticipated, and he testified he knew Alan, that Vidal had the gun. But no one ever told anybody in the bar that he had a gun. Not even Alan Howell. Not even Alan Howell, who was the subject of Vidal Brown's dislike. And he stayed there for 20 to 30 minutes after he found out that is Alan. He could have left. He could have talked to the policeman at the door, the owners, the bartenders. Nothing was ever said. And after presenting this evidence, the question comes down, well, if we're not going to ensure the safety of the invitees, what put us on notice? Why would we have any foreseeability that this young man would commit such a heinous act? And the answer is, there is no evidence. Not zero evidence that Vidal Brown would do such a thing. First of all, he was very short. And how we know it, we went to take his deposition, but he wouldn't give it. 5 foot tall, 5 foot 2 inches tall. There was nothing that he did in that bar other than walk around that would cause anybody in that bar any concern.
And, counsel, is your contention that if Section 344 restatement was civilist law, you still win?
Absolutely.
At point in this trial that you want?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Even if that's the law. And I think there was no evidence to fulfill the requirements of 344F. I mean, it starts off, and I'm reading from F, is not a possessor is not an insurer of the visitor's safety. And then it goes from there and it talks about foreseeability. From past experience, you're talking about the finest location in town, regardless of what the census tract says. I've been there. I don't know if any of the justices have been there. It is a beautiful area down there. And yet, what does the census tract say? Well, they said there was never a homicide there. There was never a shooting there, except for this one. It encompasses this entire huge area of Cleveland.
And you said there was evidence of security inside the bar?
Yes, there was testimony that there were several men in the bar working. No police officers, employees of the bar who worked. One in the bathroom, one walking around. But no one.
Is that what we might commonly understand to be a bouncer?
I suppose. I suppose that's it. Yes, a bouncer.
So when the term no security is used, it means there is no police officer inside the bar.
Correct. You can't have a police officer. I learned in this case, and I mean, Officer Dunleavy may have
done a little research occasion.
And I'm sure my colleagues and judges, police officers were not allowed to be in the bar. There happened to have been two police officers in this bar that night off duty with weapons. And when the shooting took place, they were there. And this is a coincidental thing. They were sitting by the door. But they can't work in the bar as security. They're not allowed to because of the rules of the police department. That's why the officer was
there. There's not evidence offered as to the training of the employees who are not police officers with respect to security issues.
No, because it was a direct verdict that closed the plaintiff's case. But in this case, it would not have made any difference unless we frisked this guy. And I'm not a criminal lawyer, but you just can't frisk somebody because they look weird or they dress strange. We don't have a metal detector. But if you follow what the plaintiff is saying in this case, you're saying in effect, look,
If you serve whiskey, if you have a restroom, and you have dancing, then you have to have a metal detector and armed guards at the door, no matter how high class it is. Unless you go to their expert who says, well, he's limited to black gloves. And yet this man, when he was cross-examined, acknowledged that he never told anybody at Tower City to keep on the lookout for young black males, or ever said this before on any document that he ever wrote, either to the city of Cleveland or to his employer. I think you went a little far out. What I'm saying is that this was a high-class bar. No one ever had any problems. No one was concerned. Not even the people who were there or involved. Not even plaintiff's own witnesses. So we used 344 as the law fine. It still wouldn't get it past the directed verdict. Citizen doesn't get it past the directed verdict, nor does rights. And that's our position. If you have any questions, I'll go ahead and answer. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Mr. Forrest, you've used your time, but may it take 30 seconds?
Yes. Since I only have 30 seconds, what I will ask you to do is what I know you will do, which is please base your opinion on the record. Because I sat here and I thought perhaps Mr. Trump was at a different trial than I was. There's not a nice way to say this, but most of what he said is not contained in the record. And the record, and if I had time, I would cite the page in line, the record indicates that the only security that was there, so-called security, was a man who was to guard the restroom to make sure that the correct gender go into the correct restroom. He had no security training. The only security up front was the man, the officer who couldn't go inside. The doorman, who was the so-called security person, was not only checking IDs, who had no training in that, but was also taking the cover charge and having to do other duties as well. The bartenders were busy. That was what the record was. There were no security people in there, and if they were, then I perhaps went to a different case.
Well, isn't the question? Go ahead. Isn't the question, did they need the security? Whether it's there or not, do the facts of the case dictate that they needed security?
Yes, Justice Sweeney, they absolutely do, because of this was a high crime area. However it was described, it is a high crime area. It's the 1 and 2 area. There were numerous homicides in the area. In fact, when the expert, Mr. Franson, went there for an investigation, he noticed that the announcer, the doorman, was using a wand, which is what he suggested part of the solution was, using a wand, less intrusive. If I can conclude,
the high crime nature, was it inside buildings or was it outside in the area in the census tract generally? Do we know from the record?
I believe that it includes everything. It doesn't distinguish between outside and inside.
Or it's not distinguished by bars or upscale or downscale or whatever, I assume.
Interestingly, in the Doe versus SYS parking case, which is a appellate case from Cuyahoga County, which Justice Sweeney concurred in, that case refers to expert testimony that this was a crime magnet due to the concentration of parked cars, buildings where various offices and administrative agencies take place, criminal justice system is located, crime magnets, including hubs for public transportation and various adult entertainment establishments. I would submit to you that that sounds like the Flats, Tower City, and the adjoining area. So it would seem to me that to the extent that those cases are similar, there was evidence in both that this was a high crime area, and using the attendant circumstances to stand out.
Your red light's up, but I want to pursue, since you challenged the statement as to what was actually proved in the presentation of the plaintiff's case, how did you establish? What did you use to establish there was no security? You define security as police officers, or did you pursue that further as to the employees who actually are present and their training and instruction with respect to any disturbance might occur?
Anybody but you. The evidence presented to Mr. Chacola across the nation, he was the owner of the premises, as well as the other people who employees who call us witnesses. But Mr. Control, in in particular, indicated that the man in the back, the so-called security man in the back, was only there to watch the rest of it. And the testimony indicated that this was a very small facility with specific people in it, and you can't really see. And we established the testimony that they're very difficult to see. We also established that the man in the back was not connected electronically in any way to anyone else, so that even if he saw something, he'd have to fight to it for the crowd to get there. The evidence of Mr. Piccolo was that it was their policy, their own policy, to check two IDs for everyone coming in. The evidence to the contrary was obviously that Dale Brown was under 21, he was 20. Tyler and the other person, Linkscale, also testified that they had come in on numerous occasions while underage. There's a plaque that we found and discovered that is supposedly placed to indicate the procedure to use. That plaque wasn't even out. So to answer your question, Justice Pike, would we prove the lack of security or what they didn't have through their own testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.